This next session is as advertised. This is our time for a panel discussion where three of our speakers have agreed or been coerced, I don't know, they can divulge that later, into sitting here at the front as a panel. I've already received a few questions, which I'll be putting to the panel shortly. And then there should be time and opportunity for you, as and when you come up with further questions, to either put them in writing or we can solicit them from the floor. And this is a wonderful chance to hear a range of perspectives on any number of topics. There may be things that you heard yesterday that you would like to hear a further development of, or to dig a little deeper. You may want to challenge positions that have been presented so far. But this is a wonderful chance for us to learn. There are three people to my left. Two of them, if you've been for the duration of the conference, will be familiar to you. But on my left here is John McPake. And John is going to be speaking to us in our next session. And perhaps you could tell me a little bit about who you are and what your work is. And then I will remind you that we have Rose Dowsett, who's already shared with us this morning and yesterday, and then Mike Parker at the end of the row. So, Mike, I wonder if you could pass the mic down to John. John, who are you?
Okay, very good question indeed. Is this mic on?
It's on now.
A very good question. John McPake, I am a minister of the Church of Scotland, and I'm currently minister in East Kilbride. In due course, I shall become the ecumenical officer of the Church of Scotland and take up that post at some point in the near future. And so my paper, as you will see from the programme, addresses questions of unity and mission. I shall bring that perspective in due course, as I have been a minister for a little short of 30 years, last 17 in East Kilbride. That's a very brief summary of who I am.
Okay, thanks, John. Delighted to have you with us here and on this panel. Now, the first question that I'm going to put to the panel, and it's a case of whoever wants to respond first, grab the microphone, and there'll be an opportunity for one, two, possibly all three of you may want to contribute an answer. But the first question is worded like this. The fear of God is an expression that can be understood in a variety of ways, so says the questioner. How should we understand it, and how should we explain it to others? So the key phrase is the fear of God. Would anyone like to offer some initial reflections or responses to that?
Since I have the microphone, I think we understand the fear of God in a sense, in the context in which we hear it. And so our understanding of the fear of God and our response to that understanding will be conditioned by whatever circumstance we are in that God speaks to us. And so there might be various senses in which we could understand the fear of God in our own personal perspective. And at that point, I shall pass the microphone on.
I think there are two angles into this. One is, what does the biblical language itself mean? Does it mean fear as in being terrified? Sometimes it does. Does it mean fear as in awe and reverence and respect, ultimate respect? It often means that. So there's a little bit of work to be done to locate that language in Scripture. Again, that was the Reformation challenge. You know, where are you getting your language from? How are you using language? As John says, there is a context dimension. Those of us who are in touch with Muslims, the predominant feeling about God is fear and uncertainty and not being able to know where you stand. And that's a destructive fear. Whereas the biblical fear, maybe it starts there, but it brings you into a relationship with God. Because of what God has done, you may know that you are welcome in God's presence. You may know where you stand with God. You may not know everything, but you can know that. Now, for Muslims, that's blasphemy. That's claiming far too much. How can you know that God is up there and he is only greater? So there is a context dimension. I suspect that context is running in some quarters in Scotland. Some of our desire to kick over the traces, to move away from this dreadful Calvinism that has been throttling us for so long. I remember working with Evangelical Alliance and before that in Episcopal networks and once describing myself to a bunch of Episcopalians, talking about mission incidentally, feeling caught between the twin terrors of Calvinism on the one hand and Catholicism on the other and wanting to be different somehow. I describe myself as a cheerful Calvinist. But that language, of course, has been quite difficult for many people. But I think we have some work to do to recover a biblical sense of awe and respect and reverence, which transforms everything and actually leads you to joy. I don't know whether you got the same sense from our first lecture yesterday, just that astonishing sense of the greatness of God. And it left me in silence, but also in a depth of joy that I hadn't noted before. And again, it's one of the Reformation themes that it's worth recovering, Reformation was about joy. It was about the sheer relief that because of what God has done through Christ, we are welcome in God's presence. And for sure, there should be a measure of fear. But I think we need to work at that concept.
Okay, thank you.
I was just going to add that the fear of God is the beginning of wisdom. I think that I seem to remember for myself that was a givenness in my own experience, and that at a very early point in my own Christian faith and the beginning of understanding, that was the kind of bedrock that the fear of God was the beginning of wisdom, and I'm sure that's the case for many of us. I think Mike did refer to the prevalence of Calvinism within Scottish culture. As far as I can tell, it's been quite a long time since Calvinism has been prevalent and pervasive within Scottish culture. And so whilst it is helpfully thrown in by journalists to sum up where we've left, as a matter of fact, I think the cultural stereotype is of not much use to us in terms of analysing where people are today.
Thanks for those responses. The next question picks up something that was mentioned in our paper earlier this morning, the paper written by Dick Dowsett. And in that paper, there was mention made of this idea of conditional immortality. And so it's a question for the whole panel or anyone on the panel who would like to respond. Could they comment on the strength of the biblical basis for this idea of conditional immortality? And it might be helpful as a starting point, Rose, if you could just reiterate exactly what is implied in broad terms by this notion of conditional immortality.
I think its contrast is with eternal conscious torment, if you see what I mean. And a lot of the biblical passages about judgment are couched in pictorial language. I mean, how do you describe something that is almost indescribable? And I think conditional immortality is saying that if there is judgment leading to destruction, destruction, if it means anything, is the end of it. You know, it's not that destruction goes on and on and on and on. I mean, I think that's where the debate has been. It's not saying universalism, but it is trying to say, is it really consistent with biblical passages about judgment that people would be in never-ending eternal torment? Now, as with many things, you can read scripture in different ways, in different passages, and there would be those who believe and hold tenaciously that scripture teaches endless, conscious, eternal torment. And there would be those who say, if destruction means destruction, surely that means there is a point at which it finishes, if you see what I mean. It's not saying that, it's not like purgatory, the perverse teaching about purgatory, that somebody goes through a refining process and then they're welcome kind of stuff.
I think my only reflection is to say that in some ways 9/11 did us a favor, because it brought back into public conversation the notion of evil, which had been being squeezed out in some parts of our world particularly. We were squeamish about it. We were certainly squeamish about the notion that God would judge evil. Or indeed, the biblical notion. There was somebody here yesterday who started his PhD on the biblical notion that God himself can do evil, which is one of the concepts somewhere, in order to bring about his purposes. Maybe I've misunderstood that, but it was an interesting angle. And once you have that, and again, this is the contrast with our Muslim friends that I have discovered, that there is no fall in Islam. Islam comes to the conclusion that if only we'd known better, we would have done our duty better, and we would be all right then. And that's an entirely inadequate explanation for what's gone wrong in the world. And the longer I think I go on as a Christian, the more I am satisfied that the Genesis story, those early chapters of Genesis, how God set things up, how he meant them to be for people and the world, and how things went wrong because of our own determination to be independent and do our own things, that was truly evil and did do lasting damage. Our friends in the Far East, I think, their concept of sin is damage more than some of our concepts of guilt or injustice or whatever. And those are interesting and helpful insights. So in one sense, to get evil back into the picture helps us to make sense of what God will then do. And as Rose says, Jesus uses pictures, images, they're very powerful and they stay with you. In the end, the details, we don't know for sure. And I think that's as far as I can get with that.
Just picking up on some of the things which have been said already, that indeed Scripture does bring images to us, and metaphors. Likewise, culture over the centuries has provided additional images, and these, to a greater or a lesser extent, draw on the biblical imagery. The biblical imagery itself and concepts such as Gehenna, Sheol, supplies images which invite us in some ways to, you know, to speculate, but there comes a point at which our speculation becomes less than helpful. Of this I am sure, that there will be a judgment and that God shall bring judgment. Of that I am certain. What I'm also aware of is that concepts of time and our perception and understanding of the biblical images are conditioned by our being in time. If we then try to anticipate the significance of the images beyond time, then That is the point at which we have gone beyond where our faith takes us. There are veils which have not been drawn back, and I myself think it is wise for us to observe where God has not chosen to unveil everything that shall yet be.
Thank you for those responses to what is a difficult and challenging topic for us all. In a second, I'm going to ask the panel to get creative. The shape of this conference has been we have taken topics that are theses that have been submitted by members of SETS. And the panel, I would like to challenge you to come up with a thesis related to the training of full-time Christian workers, be them ministers or missionaries. What could or should that look like in 2017? So obviously these will just be initial responses, some snapshots, but what are the key emphases that you'd like to see for training of full-time Christian workers in 2017?
Is that cowardice? I love the Lord's own example of having people alongside him and training them as he went. I think that a lot of our theological education has become completely detached from real life and suffers as a result. I mean, I am intrigued and saddened by how many people who have trained in our, particularly in our universities here in Scotland, or for university degrees in theology or whatever, will say to me, well, I've never opened any of those books afterwards. And I don't use that because it doesn't actually fit with what I'm faced with every day. Now, that may not be the story for everybody, but I think that a lot of our training has become very theoretical, very cognitive-based. Dick and I were involved in training people in the Philippines in particular, and we had some formal classes, but a lot of the time it was walking alongside them as they handled ministry situations and then helping them to prepare stuff that was going to be relevant, helping them to look afterwards at what they had done and reflect on it and what went wrong and what went right and the rest of it. I wonder how many of those of you who are regularly preaching have someone who comes alongside you afterwards and helps you think about what could have been done better and what was good. Do you know what I mean? And I think that kind of training actually needs to go on and on and on and on. But because we have tended to become those who do specialized training in institutions, that has certain advantages in terms of getting it done in a condensed time or whatever and having specialists. But a lot of the people who are then involved in theological training are themselves increasingly shut up to the academic world and increasingly detached from the realities of frontline ministry. And so I would love to see some very significant changes.
In my visits in and out of the Middle East, each time some things are the same, but each time I notice something different. In visits in January, around three countries, I noticed just how ordinary what most of my colleagues are doing, teaching, training people in seminaries, working alongside churches, working with agencies who are trying to reach out to displaced people and refugees. And so much of that was ordinary living. And again, you know, most of the questions I get asked are, how safe is it? Well, what's safe? They are living ordinary lives. And in God's hands, those ordinary lives become revolutionary. They become extraordinary. The last time I went on some visits, I was acutely aware of what Rose was highlighting just then, that a number of people who've been around a bit, working cross-culturally for some time, people who don't usually shout and make a noise, they are really needing mentors. And there's a real shortage of people of experience who will come and walk with them and come alongside them. To pick up on the preaching point, I think that underlines one of the things I was trying to say last night, was always finding the bigger picture. And you know, what is the purpose of ministry? The purpose of ministry is to equip the saints for the work of ministry. That's the Ephesians 4 thrust. So I sometimes was bold enough to get a group of people to help me prepare my sermon. Somebody who's a medic, somebody who's in government, somebody who's teaching, somebody who travels, somebody who's in business. How are you reading this passage? Help me. Because when I come to speak it, in the congregation there are all kinds of people there with all kinds of questions emerging from the worlds that they will go back to later that day or on Monday morning. Thank God it's Monday. That's, I think, quite a bold move and quite a helpful thing. And humbling for me, I mean, the questions I was asking were not the questions they were asking sometimes. In other congregations, we've tried to make sure that the Sunday passages are looked at by groups the week before, so or 2 weeks before, so that they get advance notice of where we're going. They get tuned in a little bit. They might be surprised with the line we take on a Sunday. Or they might think, no, that's exactly right. We said that. So it's getting people involved in the conversation. That does take extra time. But it's a different model from beavering away alone in your study and then coming out and making a presentation and then returning to the study. It's trying to build the conversation. That's just one dimension for the communication that I could suggest.
You know, just with reference to more in primary experience, which is within the training of ministers of word and sacrament, that we the models which prevailed within the Scottish context, I think, have largely collapsed in many ways and no longer sustain the nurturing of those who are equipped for ministry in contemporary Scotland. We do have the ancient universities within Scotland, but the cohorts within those universities in terms of training for ministry are just so small as barely to be meaningful. And it does seem to me that there are considerable lessons to be learned from the experience south of the border, where there are real examples of flourishing ministry training schemes and colleges, and the example of St. Mellitus, etc. You know, provide models which I think we can learn from in the Scottish context.
Absolutely, Mike. Go for it.
If the primary purpose of ministry is to equip the saints for the work of ministry, then I think it does follow that it's worth following the saints. And again, that's a rejig of your time and your priorities. Where are these folks going tomorrow? Where will they be this week? This is the sphere of their witness and their ministry, and how is what we're doing together going to make a difference to what they have to do during the week? And again, I know other church leaders who have taken a day every so often to spend a working day with somebody in the congregation, and just to see what life looks like from the top of the new bridge going across the Forth with an engineer. I don't think I could do that myself. I'm getting wobbly with heights, but go and be with them. It's amazing the difference that makes to them that someone from the church is actually taking that seriously. But of course, it then informs what you are engaged with in communicating yourself. Just another idea.
Thanks for that. I mean, I'm not sure we narrowed it down to a neat and tidy thesis, but I think I'm hearing words, the idea of something that is relational, something that's practical, something that's collaborative, and something that's not afraid to do something different from all that has gone before. So thanks very much for your contributions there. I'm now looking beyond the panel and myself to the floor here and to see if there are questions or things that people would like to raise with the panel or perhaps challenge them. And I see we have a roving microphone. So if you could raise your hand and wait for the microphone. Fergus has his hand up in the front row, and we'll see where we end up.
Thanks, Gavin. Coming back to the question of conditional immortality, rightly you said, all of you said, that there's a lot of pictorial language. But it seems to me that, I'd like to know what your comment on this is, the key point is the fact that Jesus uses the same adjective for life as for destruction, eternal. He says life is eternal. He says destruction is eternal. Now, can that be reconciled with conditional immortality?
Thanks for raising that, Fergus.
You're right. I don't know what more to say. I mean, I think one of the questions that came from the paper we heard was, how are we using this? And you commented, Dick commented on what you might call the threatening model. But there are times to warn people. When somebody is about to walk in front of a car in Cairo, you need to find an Egyptian to go lane by lane across five lanes. If you do it yourself, you could be in great danger, and you need to be warned. It's a game of chicken, and if you lose your courage halfway, as I did once, it's a dangerous place to be. That's a tiny, trivial example. There is a strand of warning. And the life we are constructing for ourselves needs to be warned against. I talked a little bit about our Western bubble. And I think there was an extraordinary theme emerging in yesterday, particularly about us here wanting to be faithful here, but needing now to learn from God's people elsewhere who are learning things ahead of us and who are learning things, some of them, the hard way. Yeah, the warning theme is a real theme, and there are times to do that. It's best to do it on the basis of a relationship rather than thundering from a distance, I think. But those things are there, and what shall we do with them? These are the words that Jesus used. And we have to be open and honest about that. And I think, again, you said it, or Dick said it, you know, take it up with God is the kind of implication. I have to communicate what we have written in front of us, what we have here to say. And some of them I can't easily explain how they work, and lots of people are trying to find different explanations for it. But we have to go direct to the author in that sense.
Let me just add, conditional immortality is not a modern invention. You can find it in some of the early church fathers. It goes back right to discussions and debates right at the beginning, really, of church history. So it's not just a new thing. But I would have to say, personally, I'm a bit agnostic, if you know what I mean, because I have to say I don't know how to put all the biblical data together. And I think sometimes we are left with situations where you can take different verses and different things, and they seem to be saying different things. And our Greco-Roman pattern taken into the way that Western discourse has developed over the centuries is always to try to end up with either or. You know, it's this or it can't be that. Do you know what I mean? It's and sometimes I think we're left with having to say, shall not the judge of all the earth do right? And I don't know is the answer. I do know that judgment is real. I do know that it's fearful. And I do know that the only escape is through the Lord Jesus. How that plays out in all its many details and applications, I have to say, I don't know. And maybe sometimes we have to be able to say, I don't know, but I trust the one who does.
Thank you, Rose, Mike, and Fergus. Has anyone else got a question from the floor that they would like to raise? And if you raise your hand, the mic will come to you. In the meantime, John, who's sitting to my left, has something he'd like to ask or raise.
Well, it was a question which occurred to me yesterday, just when we were discussing the openness of Christians from other cultures whose churches were now rooted in Scotland. Why were they not identifying with other churches in Scotland? And I think that experience contrasts in many ways quite sharply with what's happening in the English context. Obviously, my kind of sphere of interest is in bodies ecumenical. And so, for example, in England, you have churches together in England. That body began in 1990 with 16 members and now has 40-plus members. A significant number of these are churches which are the churches of ethnic migrant communities. I was sitting next to a man who was there at a meeting in London, and he was a representative of the Redeemed Christian Church of God, primarily a Nigerian in origin. And I asked him how many churches might you happen to have in Scotland, or did you have any? And he casually said, 50 to 60. And if there are 50 to 60, I hadn't noticed them. The Church of Scotland will be supporting an application of the Presbyterian Church of Ghana in England to join churches together in England. We see none of that at all within the Scottish context, and I'm interested to know why that should be.
Thanks for raising that. That picks up some of the themes from David Smith's paper and discussion yesterday. Rose or Mike, is there anything you'd like to say in relation to that? Thanks, Mike.
Only just a couple of quick comments. Evangelical Alliance across the UK used to have, along with it, the Afro-Caribbean Evangelical Alliance. Eventually, that closed and joined with the Evangelical Alliance. A tiny sign of a maturing relationship. Tim, our own local world, the ministers' group who meet to pray every so often, includes Redeemed Christian Church of God members, and the relationship there was forged right at the beginning. I think they came to John, and John related with them, and then brought them to introduce them, and there are cross-invitations. The relationship is there. The flavors are very different, but the relationship is there, and that's a small sign of hope as well.
And in that example, the relationship is based on a commitment of church leaders to pray together. That's the point of unity.
I think if you live in a country overseas different from your own, there is a deep longing to be secure with people like yourself. And you have to work very, very hard at learning to be at home with the people. You may be quite convinced that the Lord has sent you to wherever, but you still have to work at getting past that barrier of wanting to retreat back to your own kind. And so I think what we're seeing at the moment is that many of those who have come into our country, particularly those who are recently arrived, for language reasons, for culture reasons, for identity reasons, feel more at home with their own people. I think what we have to do is, somebody said yesterday, we have to patiently keep working at ways of helping them to be sufficiently confident and welcome that they are able to be part of what is going on in the mainstream. And I suppose I don't like the model of ethnic churches, because I think it is a denial of the inclusiveness of the gospel. I think as a transitional stage, I can understand why it may be the bridge to something different. What disturbs me far more is when you have certain communities which go on generation after generation, and that seems to me, I'm sad about that.
I mean, I suppose part of what I was saying was, why within the English experience are churches from those communities now be wishing to identify with the wider church community to an extent which I'm not sure we see within the Scottish context? Why might that be?
Very provocative, and this might be something that we continue to chat about over lunch. We're now going to move on to a different question from the front left, as I see it.
My impression from yesterday and today is that the church in Scotland faces many challenges within its own society and culture. Do we as Christian community have any contribution towards world evangelism other than finance and technology in various areas? What's your opinion?
I think we absolutely do. I think providing we learn the lesson first of becoming receivers as well as givers. Traditionally, we've been givers. The example I'm thinking of is the Brazilians who have come in some numbers recently back to Scotland from which they heard the gospel. And they have realized our challenges and in some ways our state. And they have felt called to come. Now, they've not always done brilliantly cross-culturally, and we see that in the Middle East also. They look the part, but they come from a world a very long way away in terms of how they relate to each other. But they're coming, and they are learning. And we, I think, have had to face a real challenge, as evidenced by how long it took to recognize even existing Presbyterian ministers from Brazil coming here. But it's happened. And it's happening. Emotionally, we're still struggling, I think, to accept that we may not be able to manage on our own. We are part of God's global community, and God is shuffling it up. I think that still means we have a part to play, perhaps not in the heroic missionary individuals that we sometimes think of, but in terms of simply embracing this mixing. And Scottish people who become working witnesses in the medical field or the technical field or the hospitality field, they could move into the Middle East tomorrow in many places. And they can reach people that most of us who are so-called missionaries never get near because of the vehicles that they have available to them. The whole challenge to build partnerships with relationships, sending people, budgeting to send people to visit, and making those things work in our churches. Now that's looking at something we could really work on, I think. So I'm confident that we still have a part to play, but I am saying that the balance has changed, and I think that's what David Smith was alerting us to yesterday. It's been changing for a long time, and we now need to learn to receive as much as give. I sometimes think of the Dead Sea as a Middle East illustration. You know, the Dead Sea is dead because it's all input and no output. And most of the people that some of us work with, it's mostly output and not enough input. But it's a sign of the balances that we need to pay attention to in our churches.
Thanks for that, Mike. I'm conscious that our time is almost up, but I wonder if there might be a brief final word on that topic.
Just two comments. One is the Lord still seems to be convicting people that he wants them to go somewhere else to help or to learn. So who am I to say the Lord's got it wrong? And I also would say from the East Asian context, which is the one that I know best, there are still huge swathes of East Asian communities where there is no gospel witness at all. I can't shut my eyes to that.
David Smith's paper, you know, made a fair use of the concept of paradigm shift, and we are, I think, I'm reasonably confident that we are in a time in which we see that the paradigms which have undergirded our understanding within the Western tradition as having decisively shifted. The contribution of that tradition is diminishing, and I think, as Mike was saying, we are both receivers and givers, and I think principally we shall be receivers, and to that extent our paradigm or our self-understanding will itself change, and in many ways we might find ourselves better equipped. And it does go back to a little of what I was raising earlier. You know, as we receive, as our self-understanding changes, we might find ourselves more adaptable, open in terms of our response of giving, which is the consequence of our having received.
Okay, our time comes to a close. Thank you to your contributions from the floor, and a special thank you to Mike, Rose and John for their willingness to be grilled on these various topics. I think it'd be appropriate if we just showed our appreciation. And now, over to our chair.